You're on Radio National Summer Breakfast, and now we continue our rail journey with travel journalist Andrew West. Last time we caught up with him, you might remember, he had embarked on his journey across Asia and Europe from Beijing. His eventual destination, Inverness. That's right, just a lazy 14,000 k's or so. His preferred form of transport, of course, was the Trans-Mongolian Railway. And that was at least the first leg of it. Andrew West, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be back.
Now, last time we spoke about this evocative journey, we ended up roughly here. Now, what is that?
That was us being hoisted about 10 metres off the ground as the railway carriage was lifted into the air and a new set of bogies, which is basically an undercarriage, was inserted onto the train. China and Mongolia run on different rail gauges. So there's this three-hour layover at the Mongolian-Chinese border where the train is equipped with a new set of wheels.
And you were 10 metres in the air watching this happen.
Yes, I think I said to you last time that under normal health and safety conditions in any Western country, this would not be permitted. But this being China, and this being the rail journey of a lifetime, they allowed us to stay on the train. So yes, the body of the train is hoisted into the air.
It's incredible to think about. Now, you started in Beijing, you're heading now into Mongolia. You spent a bit of time in Mongolia, I understand. What was that like?
We had a couple of a few days layover in Ulaanbaatar, the capital. I could be honest and tell you that what I really think of the city in its aesthetics.
Right.
It's a fascinating place, though, Mongolia, in the sense that he was a satellite state of the Soviet Union, never part of the Soviet Union, but a satellite state of the Soviet Union, and you can still feel the enormous Russian influence there. Not simply the language, but there's a big Russian expatriate population. There's a lot of Canadians and Australians there as well involved in the mining industry.
Yeah, tell us about that. I didn't realise that there was a big mining thing going on in Mongolia.
I'm not familiar with all the details, but I know that there's a big minerals industry that's going on in Mongolia. This is a country that was once, its best export, I think, was cashmere and mohair and stuff like that. Well, now they're digging stuff out of the ground, and that's brought a lot of money. It's also brought a lot of resentment, too. There has been an increased number of attacks on foreigners in Mongolia. We discovered this in a conversation we had with an aid worker whom we met just casually one afternoon at a monastery in the hills outside Ulaanbaatar.
Tell us. Keep going. I want to hear that.
Oh, well, he simply pointed out that there was a rising level of resentment at, and I guess this happens in most stages of development with countries, the clash between the newly affluent and those left behind. Mongolia still remains quite a poor country. Mm. The standard of housing is pretty poor. And in Ulaanbaatar, you still find, those cinder block Soviet-style housing estates, but there are also springing up these new, sparkling new villas, and they are the homes of the nouveau riche. So there is some sense of resentment, and a lot of that new money is connected with foreign mining interests.
Now, the stamp of that Russian history, even though, as you say, it wasn't part of the Soviet Union, but the stamp of that's kind of still there, not just with housing and the like, but also with army bases.
Yes. In the middle of Mongolia, at a town called Chor, which is spelt C-H-O-I-R.
Yeah, I was hoping you'd say that, because I was going to go for choir.
In the middle of Mongolia, on the flat plain that just stretches as far as you can see, is the remnants, really, of the largest Russian military base in Central Asia. It's no longer there. It's been decommissioned. And with that process came the lapse of this town into dereliction. But it's quite stark when you're stopped at this military base in the middle of nowhere. I mean, that's the extraordinary thing about Mongolia. You are literally in the middle of nowhere. You're sort of almost equidistant from the oceans and the water, from the various poles of the earth. And here was this enormous military base. It's now derelict. And literally, it's like a movie. You might see a little tumbleweed or spin effects rolling across. You might see a herd of wild horses or goats or something. But this really is a very stark reminder of how important this country was strategically to Russia, especially during its tensions with China.
Now, you're on a train. You left China, you're going through Mongolia, you're heading towards the Russian border. How long's that trip?
That's about 36 hours. But
just a lazy 36 hours.
a lazy 36 hours, but I'll tell you what really animates it. Mm-hmm. You get a sense of the Trans-Mongolian Railway as a continuation of the old Silk Route, the old trading route. The Mongolian traders get on the train in Western China. They are stocked, they are packed to the gunnels with cheap consumer goods, mainly clothes and things like Tupperware. They stack that, they pack their cabins with all these consumer goods. They cart them right across Mongolia and sell them in Western China for three or four times, and sell them in Eastern Russia for three or four times the price they paid, still being about 40% of what the Russians would normally pay. There's this enormous sense that this is not just a means of transportation, but this is an economic and commercial lifeline. And I think it's also part of what keeps the Mongolian economy going as well.
You mentioned that when we spoke last time about how this train route, you were saying it in reference to China, but it's actually part of the routine of people who live there. It's not just a tourist attraction.
It's not a tourist attraction at all. In fact, for much of the journey, we were the only Westerners, at least in the first-class cabins. And when I say first-class, they're the price equivalent of less than an economy-class train elsewhere. Mm. But yes, these are trains that particularly Mongolian traders use, and they turn the trains into a moving bazaar. So if you're a sticky beak like I am, you'll walk through the train and you'll to crane your neck to try to get a glimpse into the various compartments of other travellers, and they'll be set up like small shops and stores in the vestibule areas of the train where you board and disembark. Mm-mm. You'll find shop dummies dressed in fashion clothing. You'll find the models, the mannequins, and these mannequins will be used when the train arrives, particularly in Eastern Russia. The mannequin will be placed on the platform where the train may stop for 10 or even 20 minutes, and it becomes a kind of moving department store, and the people surge towards the train. Normally, when you're on a train, people on the platform surge towards the train to sell you something. On this occasion, it's Russians, it's Siberians surging towards the train to buy these cheap consumer goods.
This is very evocative stuff, but I want to hear a bit of a bit of this, really. So who are these people, Andrew?
These are the Mongolian traders selling jeans, rugs, Tupperware, other clothing items out the windows of the train just as you've crossed the border into Russia, around Ulan-Ude. Near Lake Baikal, which in itself is a story.
Tell us a little bit about that lake.
Lake Baikal is the world's largest concentration of fresh water. Apparently, the world could live for 40 years. The world's population could survive for 40 years on Lake Baikal water.
Wow.
At various times, the Soviet Union polluted this water. It was tragic. The lake has been rehabilitated. In places, it's 5 or 6 kilometres deep.
What?
It can be 5 to 6 kilometres deep. As you wake in the morning, as you cross the border overnight from Mongolia into Russia, you wake and there on your right-hand side, depending on which side of the train you're sleeping, is this lake. You look out and you'll see on the horizon, is it a cloud? Is it a mountain? You can't be sure because the lake is so wide and so vast. It's a huge inland sea. It's visible from space. Mm. And this has been really the lifeline for eastern Siberia. And around Lake Baikal are a whole series of villages. But at the tip of Lake Baikal is Irkutsk, the largest city in Siberia. They describe it as the Paris of Siberia. I was very suspicious, given that so many places, Melbourne's supposed to be the Paris of Australia.
Beirut was the Paris of the Middle East.
Beirut was the Paris of the Middle East. Buenos Aires was the Paris of South America. Irkutsk is supposed to be the Paris of Siberia. I was suspicious of it until we arrived and really saw some very stunning Parisian-style architecture. So Lake Baikal is both a place of natural beauty and very close to this very becoming Siberian city with lots of classical architecture.
It's a great place to leave it, actually. It's a bit of a to be continued there. Thanks very much for your time and for providing those images and that audio, Andrew. Great to talk to you.
It's my pleasure.
Andrew West, Sydney Morning Herald travel journalist, will soon be joining the ABC Radio National team, actually. We'll catch up with him once more to hear about the final leg of his trip.